Funding for On Point provided by Liberty Mutual Insurance. For auto, home, life, and business insurance needs, Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. We race through life to make a buck, to pay the bills, to climb a ladder. And every once in a while, maybe this summer when you are on vacation, comes the question, what am I doing? How could I slow this down, find a life with more magic, more majesty? My guest today tells a story of that kind of life, doing one good thing incredibly well, of a singular passion, and the world's greatest piece of cheese. This hour on Point, Michael Paterniti takes us to a cave in Spain and the Telling Room. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you dream of slowing things down, pursuing one great passion, wherever it might lead? 1-800-423-8255 is our number. That's 800-423-TALK, or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Portland, Maine, is writer and journalist Michael Paterniti. His first book, Driving Mr. Albert, A Trip Across America with Einstein's Brain, was a New York Times bestseller. His new book is called The Telling Room, a tale of love, betrayal, revenge, and the world's greatest piece of cheese. You can read an excerpt and see photos at our website, onpointradio.org. Michael Paterniti, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So we're going to kind of suspend our, you know, sharp-edged cynicism and the rest here for a minute, because you certainly do, in a great big kind of all-over-the-place story that's quite wonderful in its way. I don't know. We're going to go a lot of places here, but tell us a story, Michael. What puts you on this trail to a little cave room in Spain and a very particular cheese? Tell us a story.
Yeah, I'm almost embarrassed to say this started 22 years ago
when I was a publisher. Wail and weep.
I was a grad student at the University of Michigan. I was completely flat broke and was trying to pick up some extra money. So I went to the there known as Zingerman's, which is pretty famous place, sort of a great foodie haven, a big Ann Arbor tradition to go there and order sandwiches before football games.
Zingerman's Deli.
Yeah, a fantastic place. And so one of the owners, Ari Weinzweig, would travel the world and bring back food from all different countries. He'd bring back recipes. He'd bring back the stories about the food and the histories. This was in 1991. And they allowed me to proofread the newsletter that he wrote reporting on his travels. So he was like the Indiana Jones of food. And I was, his humble proofreader.
Okay.
And there was an October newsletter from that year in which they were sort of celebrating all these Spanish foods, and there was this four-paragraph entry about a piece of cheese known as Páramo de Guzmán. Mm. And in these four paragraphs, he described this cheesemaker, this little cheesemaker in a tiny village on the Meseta of Castile, who, from an old family recipe, made this cheese from sheep's milk. He milked the sheep. He took it into a stable, stirred the milk over a fire till he had the cheese, and then took the cheese to an old family cave where he aged it for a year, after which he would sort of soak it in olive oil. And I remember very clearly the cheesemaker's name was Ambrosio, which seemed sort of impossible.
Yes.
And fairy tale-ish.
Yes.
In its own right. And I ripped this from the final newsletter, folded it up, and kept it with me for, almost another 10 years until I was a journalist going to Spain on assignment. And I had this fantasy of trying this cheese. At the time, it was so expensive. Zingerman's had never sold a cheese as expensive. And being broke, I couldn't really afford it. It was also sold in a little white tin. You couldn't just buy a tiny piece. You had to buy the tin of it. I think it was $22 a pound at the time. It was a king's ransom for cheese.
And off you go, kind of locking yourself into Ambrosio's magnificent obsession. And this cheese, it wasn't just Mr. Weinzweig who thought it was great. I mean, this is a cheese that out of this little, sort of cave stable production, 100 miles or something north of Madrid, became an obsession all over the place. I mean, Ronald Reagan and I think Frank Sinatra, you wrote, and Fidel Castro tried to buy the whole world supply of it, which wasn't a whole lot.
It was an absolutely sort of improbable tale. And, you know, when I went in the year 2000 to Spain, I was on assignment for Esquire magazine. I was there to profile the great chef Ferran Adrià, who was basically reinventing cuisine as we know it. He was sort of leaning into the future with these foams that he made. The foams tasted like asparagus or bone marrow, and he was just completely avant-garde and sort of known as the Salvador Dali of cuisine. And I had one off day on a Sunday. We were north of Barcelona. I was with a friend of mine, Carlos, who was translating because I know no Spanish. And I had this, you know, I had this piece of paper still from the newsletter, and I said, hey, let's go up to that village and try that cheese. And we went up to Guzman, and we met this Ambrosio character in his family cave in what's known as a telling room. And these telling rooms are built above the caves.
You toss family cave off like everybody's got one outside the Flintstones. I don't know. What do you mean family cave?
Well, in Guzman, and on the north part of the town, there's a hill. And into this hill are dug, you know, at least 30 or 40 caves. These caves were dug originally during Roman times, and they were used to refrigerate the wine and the cheese and everything that was brought in from the harvest so that they could eat that food throughout the year. Over time, as refrigeration mattered less, they also would go to these caves and sort of gather, and they built these little rooms above the caves called telling rooms. And these are rooms with sort of a simple wood plank tables, a fireplace, usually a bundle of grapevines that they use to cook the lamb on, and they share wine and cheese and sit and tell their stories and their dreams and their histories. And it was into one of these telling rooms that we walked to meet this cheesemaker, Ambrosio.
And this, what you describe, it's this Pleistocene city on a hill, sort of just imploding Castilian rock, kind of a sulfuric slight bouquet of manure around the town, all these locked up fortresses. And then read for us from the passage in your book where you meet Ambrosio. Could you read that? We just got a few minutes before the break here.
Yeah. Venga, said a booming voice, come this way. This was the man on the phone, the cheesemaker himself, the Ambrosio. A bulky form filled the frame, head slightly stooped to fit the opening. Then he moved back to make way for us. His voice echoed in that cramped room like shockwaves. I'd expected him to be much older, his father's age maybe, had envisioned him in his own black beret, maybe even with a cane, small and humped and slightly deaf. But no, here he was, resolving before my eyes into a strapping specimen of ample Falstaffian belly, in his mid-40s with a full head of thick parted hair and mournful eyes. He possessed a broad face, close-set eyes, and a prominent nose, the full effect of which left the impression of a surprising handsomeness. He was dressed in dusty work boots, and the cuffs of his pants were dirty too, but he also sported an elegant collared shirt with thin navy pinstripes and a pocket embroidered with his monogram, AM. The cheesemaker sat heavily on a chair at the head of the table, offering us the bench across from his father.
This kind sounds kind of simple and straightforward, but you are meeting here. You come to know and to convey a kind of Zorba the Spaniard, not the Greek, the Zorba the Castilian. I mean, this guy with a gigantic dream and wish and desire and passion and obsession around this cheese, in which he's looking for and finds what that you also kind of look for and find, Michael?
Well, he had taken this old family recipe that had been, the family had no longer made the cheese, so he reached back into the past to recover this cheese. And everything about Ambrosio, as opposed to, say, Ferran, who was leaning into the future, everything about Ambrosio was backwards looking. And he really, really stood in opposition against this modern world that we live in, this sort of life moving at digital speed. He was the counterpoint to that. And the cheese became very symbolic of this slow way of living and this slow way of making food. And he truly believed that everything that he believed in, purity, love, all these things, honor, this Castilian code that he lived by, was in this cheese, that he made it by hand with such care that if people were to try it, they would also taste that and that they would inhale this and it would become part of them too. And I loved the sort of romantic idea of that, of course, and especially sort of stepping out of my own world in which I was, constantly on deadlines and planes traveling here and there as a reporter. This was very enticing, and I fell under my own sort of spell.
And off we go in the telling room for Michael Paterniti. Something maybe we can all relate to. I mean, something looking for that, that thing well done, done out of love, that opens a key to culture and richness and history and majesty and maybe obsession. We're going to hear about this story, and listeners, maybe hear your parallel stories if you've got them. You can join us this hour. Michael Paterniti's new book is The Telling Room, a tale of love, betrayal, revenge, and the world's greatest piece of cheese. Did you read him on Einstein's Brain, Driving with Mr. Albert? Are you ready to follow him into Castile and Spanish cheese country, the passion, the cave, the telling room? Are you drawn to great obsessions? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a beautiful obsession, the power of place and story, and one man's pursuit of the world's greatest piece of cheese and maybe a richer life. My guest is Michael Paterniti. His new book is The Telling Room, a tale of love, betrayal, revenge, and the world's greatest piece of cheese. There's an excerpt at our website. He got caught on this story, went back to it again and again and again, moved his family into Castile country, north of Madrid in Spain, to be closer to the cheesemaker Ambrosio and this whole world that took him back, took him into a world of slow food making and slow storytelling and roots and maybe a richer life. You can join the conversation this hour. Are you drawn to great obsessions, to the whiff of a deeper, richer, more magical life, a more magical, wondrous way of looking at life? Are you just back from vacation and missing the sublime, the joy of savored days? Do you envy Michael Paterniti and his story here? You know, the couple of huge threads here. I mean, this idea of the thing done well, how consuming and rich it can be, but also stories told at leisure and long, and just sort of this whole life. We asked, on the world's greatest cheese, it's funny, Michael, we've got people really responding. Leonard says here, look, if he's on the trail of the world's greatest cheese, I guess we'll be seeing him here in Vermont. So everybody's got their idea of where that is. But we also asked all of our listeners to Ambrosio's obsession here. We said, what do you produce that's all about passion, not profit? And what do you get from it? And we got a ton of kind of moving responses to that. And I will get to some of those later in the hour.
Yeah, I'd love to hear those.
I don't want to keep, I mean, your book keeps the cheese under a veil for quite a while, but I wish you would just share with us your description of the cheese, your first taste of the cheese, so we can sort of judge from your reaction what we make of this thing that was the portal for you and Ambrosio to sort of time travel and everything else. You've got a little reading there from the book on the cheese itself, this Paramo de Guzman.
Yeah. This is the first time I tasted the original cheese, and this was after, over a decade of waiting, I think, for the moment.
Yeah.
So I put Ambrosio has cut me a piece of the cheese, and I've put it in my mouth.
Where are you when you're tasting this? Are you
this is in the telling room, and this moment actually comes about because actually in a way that I never thought would, because just really quickly, when we came that first time to the telling room to meet Ambrosio, he told us this tale about what had happened to his cheese and why he no longer made this cheese. And it had to do with how the cheese became world famous, as you sort of pointed out. Fidel Castro trying to buy all this cheese, all these royal families eating it and loving it.
Yeah.
But he had enlisted his best friend, who was a lawyer. Ambrosio is just a 260-pound hulking force of nature and a fantastic storyteller, farmer, cheesemaker, but he's not a businessman. He enlisted his best friend, Julian, to come in and help him expand this business and move it from the stable across the fields to a stone factory in the village of Roa. And in the process of this move, Ambrosio would sign contracts without reading them. And he alleged that he had put his name on a contract that gave away all the rights to this cheese. So when we met with him, it was unclear whether we'd ever taste the original cheese. But so this little
passage. Is not one that he made, the one you're tasting here?
No, this is his cheese.
Yeah.
There was only one tin left of the original.
Yeah, there we go. There we go. I want to be clear about that.
Yeah, he had it. He had it hidden down in his cave. It was sort of a religious object that he kept. And so at the end of this one summer, as my family and I were taking leave of Guzman, this village, he invited us up to the telling room for a merienda, at which he had a bunch of his friends. He pulled out this last tin of cheese and opened it for us.
And we'll get to all that betrayal and dreams of murder, this sort of Tevye Zorba character. But first the cheese. Take us there.
Sure. Okay. Oh, it was a strong cheese, a Herculean cheese. You could tell that immediately. Tangy and tart, melting and then flaring again. With the first crumble, it spread slowly in lava flow across the palatal landscape, tasting of minerals and luscious buttercream, of chamomile and thyme. It tasted of flour and dirt, manure and nectar, and perhaps of love and hate, too. A gustatory alert went up and my whole mouth was watering and alive, awakened from Van Winkle slumber and emergency ready. This was a cheese that, like its master, sharply caught you unawares, lovingly provoked you while assuming your submission, and then its richness overwhelmed all previous thoughts, tastes, memories. I now understood, if vaguely, how the cheese must have created a conduit to the past, for its concentration was a force, an energy, a momentum, the psychic drill bit boring a wormhole in this Castilian space-time continuum.
That is some cheese, baby, drilling a wormhole in the Castilian space-time continuum. And there you are with a mouthful of it, all that flour and dirt and manure and love and hate, too. You get a little Like Water for Chocolate going on, or a little Gabriel Garcia Marquez. But this was a real guy, and he was really trying to get where, to do what, to live how with this magnificent obsession.
He was trying to live like an old Castilian. He was trying to live like the great figures from the past, including the great knight El Cid. He was trying to live by this code of honor, you know, like when a person's word is what counts and their handshake. He also felt that while he wasn't necessarily religious and that he wasn't going to church every Sunday, that he felt nature, this world around him, was speaking to him and offering him these small miracles every day. And he took these miracles. And so his life was full of this joy. There was immense joy in going out and harvesting the grapes or driving a tractor to plow the fields. He just found this unbelievable sort of epiphany in it every day, this agrarian way of living. But he was also, again, you know, this fantastic storyteller. And so more than anything, he collected these stories from the past and from his own life. And one of the legends he certainly told me was of this cheese. And so even in the title, The World's Greatest Piece of Cheese, has everything to do with Ambrosio telling the legend of his cheese. I know there are many great pieces of cheese. I've had more than a few of them myself, but I fell completely under his sway. And I think what he was trying to give me, this guy who landed from another planet, lost in the modern ways, was just a sense of this, a taste of it. These moments with him that became timeless. And so, you know, as he told these stories, I became a child again, you know, quite literally. I felt like I was listening to my mom or dad, you know, laying in bed before sleep as a kid. And, you know, I just didn't want that to end. It was a very pleasant way to pass a day.
I mean, and this wasn't the kind of precious collector impulse of aficionados, though some may have ended up with a couple of tins of this, I suppose. But this was, I mean, you write about fellow villagers who would come in after he had recreated this with his mother for his father, and they would smell this cheese and just be taken back. They'd just be rolled back in time.
Yeah.
Almost even past their own childhood into deep time somehow.
Yeah, that this taste, this cheese, and this kind of cheese, this sort of Castilian house cheese that has existed for many centuries. And so people did connect it to their own mothers, who many of whom made cheese themselves in their homes. But you're right, it connected to a much deeper flow of history. And that is something that Ambrosio wants to this day to keep alive. That's part of his grand philosophy. And part of it, too, is this very simple way that the old Castilian lives. So it is the perfectly timed, you know, piece of cheese. It's the perfectly grilled lamb with a little sea salt on it over the grapevines, the burning grapevines. And he is a master at sort of orchestrating days full of these simple transcendent moments. And he makes his own wine, and that's another huge part of who he is, and so there's a lot of wine consumed in his presence, and it fuels a lot of the storytelling. And he's, you know, he's a big storyteller, body, scatological, emotional,
works, yes.
Profound. So he takes you on these amazing rides.
And if you weren't immersed in the mystery and kind of emanations of all this, you weren't along for the ride. But if you were, it's something a lot of Americans long for these days, those things that really take us deep and rich and maybe back. Michael Paternini's new book is The Telling Room. Michael, lots of callers for you. Tara in Bluffton, South Carolina. You're on the air. Thanks for calling, Tara.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Today is my birthday, so this is an honor. This is awesome.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
I am a chef. I own a small business called Low Country Comfort Bakery, and I've spent a lot of time in Europe. I come from a European background. Hmm. My father is from Bologna, Italy, and my mom is a Spanish Jew. So this really touches my heart, because I, as a chef, put so much passion into making these small little savory galettes. Lived in Paris for a while, and I was always amazed at what they could get in a hand pie.
What do you mean, so, get in it? The taste, the magic,
the
aroma?
Taste, the magic, the aroma, the, like endive, roasted endive with Gruyere and a little bit of jambon de Bayonne and a little bit of beautiful sea salt. Just simple, incredible ingredients going into these magical pies. And I was, you really stymied as a chef for years. I never fit in. I went to the Culinary Institute of America. I knew I had talent, but I didn't have that spark. I didn't have that one thing. And so I identify with Ambrosio already because I know of that one thing.
So when we bite into your savory pies, Tara, what are you sharing with us? A flavor or something else?
I am sharing every moment of happiness and sorrow and anger and joy and storytelling I can give.
Wow. So, I got to come out and have one.
You're giving the gifts on your own birthday, Tara. Good for you. Tara, thank you so much. In Bluffton, one more ride. Thank you, Tara. John, happy birthday, Tara. John in Melrose, Massachusetts, you're on.
Hey, hello, Tom. Hello. Michael. It's great listening there about the history. It's interesting how an American has to go to Europe to slow down.
Yeah, maybe.
Anyway, I grew up in Ireland on a farm, and my mother's house, I grew up on a farm just a couple of miles from where my mother came from, but they had the dairy, and they preserved it. But I just heard stories about the butter and cheese making.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, cooperative creameries took over in the, I don't know, maybe the 40s or whatever. And, of course, there is a cottage industry now of cheese making in Ireland, but the storytelling happened in the rambling house nearby where they lived in the old cottage. Mm. And I think what is lost is the storytelling. You know,
yes.
People start
yes.
now and they come from Europe and they come from wherever and they have cottage industries making cheese very successfully in Ireland. However, as I say, it's not the same tradition as the cave. And there are stories in Ireland, they used to put the butter in bogs, to keep it cool, just yeah. like the cave coolness.
Yes, yeah.
And some of them were lost, and some of them are preserved. Even the butter has
oh, wow.
for hundreds of years, and some of it is in some of the boxes, at least. I don't know what they do with the butter in the National Museum in Dublin.
Anybody's great.
Over there. So in the bog, and they'd forget their box of butter.
It's beautiful.
It, and, you know, the history's right there.
John, that's a gift, that's awesome. Too. You're going to have Michael Paterniti out on the bogs of Ireland looking for that that old butter. But, I mean, there's something right there about the slow labor that slows us down, and then the stories come. I know that very well from childhood and agricultural community. And you just, when you're not laboring quickly, there's time for stories, and maybe we want and need them. One more, Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Alice, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm calling to talk about the wooden boat building that's going on in different places throughout our own country. It just seems that there's some of the same history and slowness. On the East Coast, on Martha's Vineyard, Gannon and Benjamin build wooden schooners using old techniques only, they've slowed down. Their shop is their shop looks like it could be 150 years old, even though it's only 20 years old. And the people who purchase their boats remind me of the people who purchase the cheese. They're people who can't quite slow down, but want to slow down.
Yeah,
and
I love that.
An old wooden boat. I mean, not an old wooden boat, but an old style schooner
yeah.
or smaller wooden boat, and they get on the ocean and they do slow down. And even the description of the smells, the smell of the cheese or the taste of the cheese. Mm. Well, with the wooden boats, it's the smell of the wood and the shop and
yeah.
the manual labor is even a certain kind. It's very slow labor. And
Alice, you put that so well. You put it so well from Oshkosh. Maybe we have a deep hunger for that. We're looking at one beautiful obsession this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. But it's not easy, Michael. I mean, there's a kind of, you know, Don Quixote feeling about your Ambrosio in Castile. He's beleaguered. He's plagued. It's not easy to stay with his dream. He's challenged. He dreams of murder because of his losses and his journey.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's where, you know, you have somebody who has made a bargain that's very hard to keep with the past because the forces of modernity keep, eroding his life as he knows it. And by not being a businessman and sort of being sucked into the frenzy of the go-go 80s in Spain where everybody was an entrepreneur, everybody had a $1 million idea,
mm-hmm.
He ended up losing everything and falling actually deeply into debt because he had put his signature on all these contracts promising to pay the shepherds or any of the people they were working with. In fact, he fell $3 million into debt.
Whoa.
This, again, is just a farmer. So his life was also ruined by this dream. And so I think that's where things became very interesting for me, not just as somebody who became very close to Ambrosio, but as somebody trying to tell the story. Ambrosio wanted to tell his legend as he mm-hmm. Felt it to be, and it came into conflict a little bit with what the real truth is. And I think every story is just that. You know, it's a partial fiction.
And even you out there sort of teetering on the edge, sipping from this spring of obsession and wonder, a little bit of your own Quixote going on.
Exactly.
We're talking with Michael Paterniti. His new book is The Telling Room, A Tale of Love, Betrayal, Revenge, and the World's Greatest Piece of Cheese. It's really about a beautiful obsession, the power of place and story, one man's pursuit of the world's greatest piece of cheese. A little Man of La Mancha here. Join us, 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a beautiful obsession, the power of place and story, and one man's pursuit of the world's greatest piece of cheese, and maybe a richer life. Michael Paterniti is with us. His new book is The Telling Room, A Tale of Love, Betrayal, Revenge, and the World's Greatest Piece of Cheese. You can join us. Are you obsessed with doing one thing, something very well, and just for the love of it? Does it take you into the mystic? And what about Michael Paterniti's great obsession in this book? Do you follow? Do you get it? Have you been there to that kind of fervor? You know, Michael, we asked people, on all the places that you can ask lately, Twitter and Facebook and online, what do you produce that's all about passion, not profit? What do you get from it? And people just poured out, Robin says, I teach and write history. Both bring me joy. Cracks me up when people assume academic books are moneymakers. No, they are not. Paul said, choral music with 99 of my closest friends. I get spiritual renewal, energy, a great sense of accomplishment, plenty of laughs. We take on pieces, no amateur courses. Isn't he right, doing like Mendelssohn's Elijah or Brahms' B minor mass? And on and on. Veronica, I create music. Somebody else creates open source software. Somebody else does race timing. Heather, we have the pleasure of seeing every single finisher come through, just standing and watching racers finish their race, but something done well, and not for money, but for joy. I mean, it goes on and on. People really respond to this.
I love that. I love it. It's true. I think when we find ourselves outside of this fast moving river that many of us live our days in, you get to look up and you get to be present, and you notice other people's struggles and triumphs, and that's a big part of it. This story that I was telling felt like a slow food tale gone awry, but then it also felt like an excuse to slow down, to do some slow living, some slow thinking, listening to long stories told over, days instead of even hours. And there was just immense joy and pleasure in those. It's really hard to imagine listening to anyone tell a story over the course of a weekend, but that's what Ambrosio did, and he would embed other stories inside of it, and it was just fascinating. And you're right, it was completely off sort of the clock as we know it, and it seemed to not be profitable in any way, except spiritually.
I mean, and you're following this a bit. Citizen James writes to us on the website, I'm enjoying this story of slow food from a tradition before slow food was a term. It's the real thing. Here you were kind of riding along here with Ambrosio and his digression upon digression, a story over a whole weekend, and you getting footnote upon footnote in your book, sort of David Foster Wallace-y, and even moving your wife and kids in here. Did they go for it? Did your wife roll her eyes?
Oh, yeah. She rolled her eyes, and then she went for it. She's an adventurer, too, and she did it once she got there. I think she's maybe the biggest fan of Guzman and its people, and this town was 80 people, and it was like a Gabriel Garcia Marquez novel. I mean, there was character after character. There was a man named Manuel who everybody said could fly, and they truly believed this. There was a stonemason named Chris, and he had a little secret workhouse out in the fields where he had like 12 statues of naked women, and it would have scandalized everybody in town. So everybody sort of had their secrets and their stories, and of course my lover of stories too, and a lover of people. Right, so she fell right in with them. Okay. And then we had two small children, yeah. So we had a lot of the average age there was about 80, and so we instantly had 40 sets of grandparents. It felt
though there's the backstory of you in love with this experience and that real world requirement of delivering that product of the book never quite getting done because there were grander things. El Cid was in the air. Got a little bit from that movie. I mean, Ambrosio in love with El Cid, of course, this part of Spain, but 1961 epic El Cid, played by Charlton Heston there. Here he is confronting King Alfonso, who rose to the throne by murdering his brother, King Sancho. El Cid forces King Alfonso's hand onto a Bible and demands he swear he did not kill his brother. Ah, the old ways and honor, or not.
Do you swear that you had no part by way of design in King Sancho's death?
I swear it!
If you are forsworn, may you die such a death as your brother did. struck from behind by the hand of a traitor. Say amen.
You press me too far, Rodrigo.
You press me too far. El Cid seems too armored up and grand for your Ambrosio in his cave with the tins of cheese, but maybe not, Michael.
Well, I think, you know, he's so identified with El Cid. And there was one evening where he took us on a little excursion out across the Meseta to a ghost town called Haza. And we went up there, and there's a little bar and somebody who made a wonderful stew that he wanted us to eat. And we were driving back, and he was talking about El Cid, and he became very emotional. He was so moved by El Cid and what he stood for and his honor, and he described it in such a way that even as we were driving through the twilight, you know, I could almost imagine El Cid riding next to us on his gigantic steed, you know, wielding his incredible sword. And so for these people,
the man who would bear the burdens of the world and do whatever it took,
exactly, carry the full weight of the world on his shoulders. And for someone like Ambrosio, all these ghosts from the past were riding right along with him at all times. And so these people came and went in the stories just as if they were people living in the village. And I thought that was remarkable, the way he was so in touch with the past and these histories in order to figure out, you know, the present and where he was headed.
Yeah, though, I mean, it's not all, like, quite so dreamy. The veil slips some before you're all done with this. But in that moment, I mean, there's a moment in the book where you stop in the middle of the countryside just sort of thinking about this guy and you, the American there, and what it was that you so... Well, read for us, if you would.
This is the...
The Seduction of Paganini by Ambrosio. Yeah. In a way. You're talking about envying.
Perhaps I envied a man like Ambrosio, whose strength seemed to derive from the pulse of the earth in this place, from being an old Castilian who accepted the violence and vicissitudes of nature. And yet he'd found the key to his universe in the multitudes contained by a piece of cheese, by its absolute grandeur. In my mild delirium, I eventually found it hard to think, or easier not to. I just allowed myself to register the feeling of existing there among the sunflowers. And the longer I stood and the deeper I settled into that loose dirt, the more I became a part of it, resolved to it. Approach of dawn, a few hours off, the air turned a little sweet, carrying with it a trace of chamomile. My limbs, so tired and sore from so much sitting, felt light and loose. My whole body lifted. What I felt then was an all-consuming peace, or perhaps that lack of bodily awareness. It was, I suppose, a feeling of oneness, though I would label it the cessation of an anxiety caused by the speed and decibels of every day. I breathed in one last time to remember it by.
Who cannot relate to that, maybe, but just to have it. Dee in Shelburne, Vermont. Dee, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Buenos dias, Michael.
Hi, Dee.
Hello. I am listening to this. I keep a radio in my bathroom, thank goodness, because that's where I hear all these wonderful things. And I used to live in Spain in the 60s. My children grew up there as children, so they started out life in the most beautiful way, living
great.
With the Spanish people. And I, at this time, still in my life, cook Spanish food and listen to flamenco. I play the guitar, and I read Don Quixote. I have all his books, hundreds of Don Quixote books hanging around. And that's what makes my life easier to deal with in this fast society, is going back to the days of living in Castile and remembering my friends and the beautiful foods and meals we shared.
But look at Spain. It's such a mess today, Dee. I mean, they got employment of, like, over the moon, and nobody knows what's going to happen.
I know.
I mean, that's real too, isn't it?
It's very real. When I went back for a visit, I was sick, and someone sent me back, and they said, the only way you'll get better is to go back to Toledo and be with your friends and in that country. And I did, and I got better within 2 days. And I discovered the things that had changed. Women dressed differently. They smoked in public. A lot of things had changed, but my old friends were still the same, and their love for their life and their spiritual loving of spending an hour just visiting with each other and eating good foods and drinking wine. And their past is so important in their future. It's romance that we don't have here. and I'm sad to see that going.
And here are Ambrosio trying to live that and succeeding for a good while. Dee, thank you for that call. Ambrosio, by doing an old trade and immersing himself completely in the feel of it. Jackson in Batesville, Virginia. Jackson, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi.
I'm a 25-year-old blacksmith, and I've been blacksmithing since I was 13, and it's what I do, and I do it because I love it. And it's, I can just really relate to what Michael was saying about how you know, you can just kind of get involved in what your craft is as a young person and really give everything to it. And it's just like, it's so kind of frustrating not when folks don't realize that the work that goes into it and how much effort goes into learning it and doing it and being part of that. And that's, I could really relate to what he was saying and what the fellow who's making the cheese, what he went through.
Do you feel yourself communing with the past, Jackson, when your hammer is on the anvil with some hot blacksmithing going on there?
Yeah, absolutely. You realize that you're absolutely not the first one to be doing what you're doing, no matter what it is. And the way you're doing it is an accumulation of thousands of years of knowledge. And that's just a really powerful thing that people don't realize. And it's, you know, they expect it to be as fast and the quality of something you get at a big box store. And it's just not, you don't get that history. And it's like, I'm sitting here on a Thursday afternoon, individually filing parts to get them to fit and getting people to understand that's the work that goes into it. It's just like, it's so hard.
Listen, we hope you take great satisfaction because, the economics of these things can be really tricky. In Ambrosio's case or Michael's case or your case, I'm sure, but I love that connection that you keep there, Jackson. I appreciate the call. We're looking at a beautiful obsession this hour, The Power of Place and Story with Michael Paterniti. His book is The Telling Room. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Michael, you say that your Ambrosio talked a lot about the disability of memory being the horrible plight of modern man. What was he pointing to?
He was pointing to many things, but part of it was this idea that food and taste connects you immediately back to certain memories, and that with the loss of these foods, that with the loss of, say, the chicken that's raised in you are disconnecting yourself from the land and your history there. And he talked often, he had this phrase for it too, he called divinity, not machines. And he really believed that you should be talking to the animals that eventually you would slaughter, and you should be in this conversation with the world. The disability of memory also had a lot to do with money and people trying to profit. And when it came to his best friend and archenemy, Julian, he talked about how Julian had disregarded this beautiful friendship, this beautiful past they'd had together because there was money on the table. And he just felt like this was the plague of our modern times.
So how do you get off the, sort of jump off the boat? And I mean, I've done this before, just run into places that struck me so instantly with such magic that I would just move there, an island in the mouth of the Pearl River years ago in the South China Sea that just took me over, and
wow.
Others.
Yeah.
But you sort of bohemian life out of time excursions, but it's hard to stay with them forever. What did you manage to bring back with you, Michael, and what stays there in this Castilian dream?
Well, I think there was this very real narrative battle that took place eventually between myself and Ambrosio. We were struggling for who was going to control the story. And, in my day job, I was
to
out
control the story, you're saying. We're blanking out a little bit there.
The story. Yeah, mm-hmm. to be the final teller.
Mm-hmm.
After all, this was my book. It was going to have my name on it.
Right.
And as much as I spent time listening to and faithfully recording Ambrosio's version of his life and of this story about the cheese, his cheese, Paramo de Guzman, obviously there was another side. I didn't want to know that side for so long because in my day job, I was out reporting in the world and, Guzman became a refuge for me. It became this very safe place. I became very connected to the people there. And I knew eventually as a storyteller, that part of the betrayal was going to be mine of when I went to the other side and when I began to track Julian down. And so, yeah, there was a very real, and even today, you know, I think our relationship is in a state of dynamic flux. You know, the last time I saw him was before the book came out at the beginning of July, and he said to me as I was going to leave, as he always does, "When am I going to see you again?" And I said, "Oh, hopefully in the fall." And then I made a joke, and I said, "That is if people here like the book." And he very seriously, and probably for the only time in our relationship ever, sort of fixed me with this slightly angry look, and he said, "If people here don't like your book, you best never return." And this is like a dear friend.
Wait, not return to where the people were reading it, or not return to him?
Not return there. Yeah, not come back to the village.
Wow.
So I think the story, you know, I think the storyteller is always in a slightly fraught position.
Yes,
and if you're
going to
finish a book like this, you have to accept the punishment, whatever that may be. But, you know, by and large, I feel the book is very much a love song to this place.
No question. Veil slips a little, but the love is there. You quote Blaise Pascal in Human Happiness, "Imagination magnifies small objects with fantastic exaggeration until they fill our soul." You've done a little filling with us this hour, Michael, and we're really grateful for it. The new book is The Telling Room, A Tale of Love, Betrayal, Revenge, and the World's Greatest Piece of Cheese. Michael Paterniti, thank you very much. Good luck with everything, and when you next see him, our best to Ambrosio.
Thanks, Tom.
Great to have you. We will go out with Que Contentos Están Los Mozos, traditional festival and dance tune recorded, incredibly enough, by the great Alan Lomax in Spain in 1952. Special thanks to the Alan Lomax Collection at the Library of Congress's American Folklife Center for the music used courtesy of the Association for Cultural Equity. Thanks for joining us this hour. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.